I don't pretend to be an expert in this field, but I just want to share this evening with you, out of a few years of counseling and dealing with young marrieds, some of the most serious problems that can arise in a Christian marriage. Now, I'm going to take for granted that this is a Christian marriage, that it is a marriage where both partners are genuinely converted Christians and they desire to make their marriage and their home truly Christ-centered. I've already talked about the necessity of this and that this is the most basic fundamental need of a Christian marriage. And so I'm going to presume on the fact that it is a Christian marriage. And I will not go into any of the directly spiritual problems in a marriage. We did that last Sunday night. So for the purposes of narrowing down this sermon, I'm going to presume on Christian commitment on both parts, husband and wife, and talk about some of the problems in marriage and some of those that become serious enough to break up a marriage. Now, sermons like this on the problems of marriage usually begin with this sentence, and then when the honeymoon is over, etc., etc., etc. They say there are many ways to tell when the honeymoon period is over. Someone said that the honeymoon is over when the husband takes his wife off a pedestal and puts her on a budget. Dr. Paul Popenoe, the founder and former president of the American Institute of Family Relations, says that the honeymoon is over when both stop saying to each other, "Darling, you're absolutely perfect," and instead they begin to say to each other, "The trouble with you is." Another expert says that it's the change from the period of appreciation to one of depreciation. Now, did you ever stop to think of just why there is a change from the honeymoon stage to the for better, for worse stage? Why does this come about, anyhow? I think you can chalk most of it up to the fact that before marriage, you see your beloved through the rose-tinted glasses of a highly romanticized and idealized kind of love. The man looks upon his girl as though she were sort of a goddess. And she views him and exaggerates every virtue in his life into a sort of a glorious illusion. The truth is that you only partially know each other. After all, your contacts really have been rather limited. Mostly times of dating. These alternate between times of desire and indifference. Romantic love concentrates on those times of desire and attraction. In a sense, it does not realistically deal with the moments of indifference or difficulty, or actual aversion. But once you get married, there's no escape. There's the necessity, you see, of incorporating all experiences into your relationship. The difficult times, as well as the delightful. The difficult times are not to be simply endured. They have to be woven right into the strands of married life. Then you have to add to this the fact that before marriage, one's sex desires are not being completely fulfilled. And this gives one a sense of anticipation which tints the whole relationship with a very rosy hue. When you get married, there is the completeness of sexual commitment. The Bible uses a very interesting word for this. The word in the Hebrew that we have translated into our English Bibles by the word to know. And Adam knew his wife Eve. Now there is no more romantic and illusory anticipation of this fulfillment. There is total fulfillment. No more fantasy dream. Now there is sheer total reality. There is literally nothing between you. You truly come to know each other in the fullest meaning of the word. And in this knowing, the scales fall from your eyes, and the rosy tint somehow vanishes from your glasses, and you come to see one another and to know each other as you truly are. Oh, the wisdom of that Hebrew word, to know. And so gradually there ends that period, which has been called the time of mutual enjoyment of one another, and there begins that stage of mutual adjustment to each other. But you see, this really has to be, because as someone has said, two people who are all wrapped up in each other make an awfully small parcel. And that's true. Ultimately, this kind of a love which precedes marriage, a very self-centered, selfish love, will ultimately generate not love, but boredom and restless dissatisfaction. So we're talking now about the changing of a picture. Up to now, before marriage, the picture has been something like this. Two young lovers holding hands, gazing adoringly and lovingly into each other's eyes. Now we have to change the picture. The two lovers now are side by side. They are still holding hands, but their eyes are out in front of them, fixed upon a common goal, and they are walking together toward that goal. Now, what are some of the most perplexing problems of this period of adjustment? Problems which, if they are not faced, can really break up a marriage. Now, as I say, I don't profess to be an expert here. You could hear another preacher give another sermon on this and get an entirely different list. I'm merely sharing to you the great problems, the greatest, shall I say, problems that have been brought to me to help on as a pastor. Now, first of all, and I think this first one may shock some of you, I put the word finances. Maybe you're shocked by that. But my own experience would confirm what almost every counselor and every book on the subject writes about, namely, that the most common cause of difficulty in marriage is disagreement over money. And here's the interesting thing about this. It really doesn't make a whole lot of difference upon which social level you are operating. The very rich, the very poor, all the shades and grades in between, it makes little difference as to the amount of money that's involved. The problem is much deeper than this. You see, there's really no such thing as money by itself in the sense of just a bill or a coin or a check or a bank. Money, like everything else, represents something to the person who is handling it. It represents power or achievement or status. To someone else, it represents humiliation, restriction. It represents an attempt to entrap you or to fence you in. So each marriage partner comes into marriage with their own individual associations with money. There's the background of their own home, their reactions to how their parents handle money. It was John R. Mott who said that money is minted personality. Beautiful definition of it. Money is minted personality. And so your two personalities are different, and so that your two minted personalities may be totally and seemingly irreconcilably different. Now, here in our local situation, we have a ready-made thing that gives rise to many money problems. It's only a part of the whole American difficulty. It's something like this. With our tragic overemphasis upon sex, the fact that it is thrown at our youngsters from almost birth onwards, young men and women feel strong pressures that would tend to push them into very early marriage. Marriage really so early that they actually cannot afford to get married. Yet they have little choice. I'm being very realistic about this. And so we have a lot of couples who are trying to live off of almost nothing. I don't know anything that can kill love in a marriage quicker than this sort of situation. Young couples that come to me for premarital counseling are often very shocked because I spend just a little time talking to them about sex and far more time talking to them about their financial plan and budget. It's tremendously important. My suggestion to you is that as early as possible in your married life, you put yourself on a budget. I think it should be worked out prayerfully and carefully and realistically. I think we can say this to be true as a general rule, that if you have a budget and you stick by that budget, you will live within your means and you will avoid a whole parcel of serious marital problems. And this regardless of how little you have. And the opposite is true, that if you do not have a budget, you will not live within your means, and you will have all manner of conflicts, regardless of how much you may have. David Mace makes an excellent suggestion along this line, too, in his in his book, Success in Marriage. And I always give it to my prospectives when they come for counsel. He says that when you're making your budget for your family, that that budget should include a small amount, however small, but it should include an amount where the husband and wife is completely and totally free to use that money any way they please. No questions asked, hands off by the other partner. This is a must. You see, no husband can ever quite understand why in the world his wife ever bought that idiotic and useless whatchamacallit. And no wife can ever understand why in the world her husband ever bought that ridiculous gadget for his camera or his car or something else. The point is that you don't try to understand. This is one of those great mysteries of the universe, attached to femininity and masculinity. You just walk around it, accept it. You don't try to understand it, but you give one another perfect freedom. And I think this helps to avoid a lot of conflicts. Now, the second area of marriage that can result in serious problems and even break up a marriage is the area of communication. The general inability to communicate. A breakdown in communications. Now, isn't it interesting how persons with the opposite personality patterns will usually or often be attracted to one another? The strong, silent person is often attracted to a partner who is more outgoing and talkative. We almost subconsciously reach out for a mate who will help us to overcome our own weakness by their particular strong point. Now, there's nothing really wrong in this, unless, as Paul Tournier points out in one of his books, there comes into effect what he interestingly calls the law of conjugal counterbalance. Now, he says, this is when you are so opposite that instead of helping one another and complementing each other, you drive each other into an even greater extreme by your differences. So today, one of the great problems in the American home, right here in this realm of communication, is this one. On the one hand, the quiet, impassive, unexpressive, silent husband, and on the other hand, the talkative, expressive, dare I use the word, nagging wife. Sometimes it's just the reverse, but this is the usual picture. Now, before marriage, the young man enjoyed her talkativeness. It was wonderful. She was helping to bring him out, you see. She pushed him a little bit. She drew him on. That's what you call it before marriage. But after marriage, we use another name for it. We call it nagging, you see. It's a great problem. There are hundreds of stories and jokes about this problem. Unfortunately, most of them take it out on the women. I'm not sure why. I think it's a bit unfair. You remember the man who always called his wife Angel. When they asked him why, he said, well, for three reasons. One, she always has nothing to wear. And secondly, she's always up in the air. And thirdly, she's always harping on something. Well, that must have been the situation at the divorce court that day when a man came in and filed his plea for a divorce. Well, the judge said, why? What are the grounds for your divorce? He said, Judge, I can't stand it anymore. He says, my wife, she just talks and talks. She talks in the morning, she talks at noon, she talks in the evening, she talks at night. She's still talking when finally I drop off to sleep. I just can't stand it. She talks, talks, that's all she does. Well, his sincerity and earnestness seemed to impress the judge. So the judge said, well, what does she talk about? The man said, Judge, that's the trouble. She don't say. Well, that sometimes is the difficulty. But before you persecuted men feel too self-righteous, let me add this. I don't blame some wives. What in the world does a wife do when she can't get a word out of her husband? They never say anything to them. They never share themselves, never talk about their work, never say a word of appreciation or love. Sometimes wives will come to me out of sheer desperation. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to get something across to their husband. Their husband has kind of put down a sort of a plastic shield that shuts out his wife. He's in a castle. He digs a moat and he fills it with water and he draws up his drawbridge and there he sits. And he assumes a kind of a sphinx-like indifference to everything she says and does. What can a wife do under those circumstances? Now, the worst thing you can do is to nag. For here's the law of conjugal counterbalance. The more you yak and the more you nag, the quieter he gets, the more he clams up. And the more he clams up, the more you nag, you see. You try to pull it out of him. So you get a sort of an impasse there. The more silent he's liable to become. I think wives here must understand one thing. This is one of the tragic results of a false emphasis in our American culture. We always put a few words together. The strong, silent type. You ever notice that? The strong, silent type. As if those words have to go together. Men aren't supposed to express their emotions in America. They're not supposed to let you know how they really feel down deep. But wives, let me tell you a secret. Down deep in their hearts, men are secretly wanting you to open their hearts up to them. To help them find real emotional freedom. Not by nagging, but by very carefully. You must learn to possess your soul in patience and to draw that hubby of yours out and draw out his deepest feelings. This is not going to be easy. It's going to require grace and patience. But you are equipped to do this by your very God-given gift of femininity. You have to create a warmth and a confidence which will help him to do what he really wants to do, express himself and his love. And if you do this, you'll earn your husband's deepest devotion and gratitude. Sometimes when things get desperate, I advise wives to write their husbands a letter. I say, write him a letter so he'll get it by himself, maybe at his work or some other place where you know that nobody else can receive it. Be sure you tell him how much you love him, but then frankly and openly just tell him some of the things that are on your mind that you haven't been able to communicate about. You see, men are so stupid on this. That wife, she comes crashing through my office door, weeping. She says she can't stand it anymore. And finally, when the poor husband comes, he looks at you with a blank look, like a contented cow chewing his cud out in the field. And he says, what problem? We haven't got any problems. I'm perfectly happy in my marriage. And the poor wife is about to go out of her mind. Recently I had one like this, and so I advised her to write her husband a letter so that he'd get it at his place of work. And so very lovingly, very frankly and firmly, she just laid it all on the line. What happened? I tell you, for 3 days, he was as mad as a hatter. He didn't say a word. He just went around the house. But she just poured on the unconditional love. Those were my prescriptions. She poured it on, though sometimes it was just trying to love a porcupine or a cactus. She poured on the unconditional love. And on the fourth day, he broke down. And he admitted that she was right. And he appreciated the fact that she hadn't nagged him about the things. And he said he wanted her to help him work on the problems, and together they could work things out. I tell you, when communication goes, everything goes. Love, by its very nature, demands communication. At any cost, keep the communication lines open. A good fight is better than not communicating. The fellow said it's better to be wanted for murder than not to be wanted at all. At least, even when you're quarreling, you're granting the dignity of each other's existence. It's coldness, it's indifference that kills love. For indifference is simply a refined form of hostility. It's like saying, you don't even exist, I don't even see you, who are you? You're not even there. And indifference can kill a marriage quicker than almost anything I know. Keep the communication lines open at any cost. Now the third factor that can break up a marriage is emotional immaturity. I know this is a very broad subject. I don't have time to go into it tonight. There are a lot of personality factors and emotional patterns that can really break up a marriage. I mean a good Christian marriage of two perfectly fine, wonderful, sanctified people. You see, many people marry in order to solve an emotional problem. What a tragic mistake that is. Marriage doesn't solve your personality problems. It only gives them a new arena to work in, and it'll probably increase them. The emotionally mature person, just because he walks down to the altar and says a few magic words is not suddenly made mature. The tragedy of life is a person can be 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, certainly old enough to be married, but who has never grown up in his emotional life. He's still a child. So sheer childishness, selfishness, temper tantrums, I want what I want and I've got to have it right now attitude, pouting, deep feelings of inadequacy and insecurity and inferiority, so that no matter how much love you pour on, they never get enough. They're just a grand canyon, a vast abyss of need, love, and you can never fill it. Complete irresponsibility, the inability to even make the slightest decisions. The list of these things is endless, and the results can be very tragic. And worst of all, these things tend to repeat themselves from one generation to another. And that's why you've heard me say it before, I repeat it tonight. You are not ready, you are not fit and ready to be happily married to someone else unless you are happily married to yourself. Marriage is not the answer to emotional immaturity and personality problems. Now, we don't have time to go into this area tonight, but I find that wherever I go in revivals and ashrams, and by the way, I'm doing something I've never done before. Always in every one of my revival meetings now, I preach at least one sermon, and maybe two, on this whole business of damaged emotions and the healing of the members. I find it's the most fruitful service almost in the whole meeting. This area is some of our greatest marital problems arise, and they break up some of our finest Christian marriages. Let me just say a couple of things about this. First of all, if you are not yet married tonight, and you find some problem arising during courtship as a result of an inner emotional problem, I plead with you, get help on it. Every ounce of help before you are married is worth tons of help after you are married. Don't be so naive as to think it's going to go away if you ignore it and get married. It won't. It's so much easier to take care of before you're married. Then you can work it out. It's your problem. It's easier to get at. It's easier to peel away the layers and to find healing and deliverance. After marriage, a whole new set of defenses, very intricate, layer upon layer comes and may cover it, make it so much harder to uncover to the healing work of the Holy Spirit. So get help. Counsel alone. Counsel together as a couple. But work these things out beforehand. Now, if you are married, you discover problems like this, I plead with you to have the courage in your early years of your married life to face, in all honesty, any problems like this. It takes courage to do that. It takes courage to face that inner child of your past, as Hugh Misseldine puts it, to learn how to handle that child. In the words of Paul, to put away those childish things and to grow up into maturity. Don't be afraid to do it. Get help on it. The trouble is, in Christian circles, there are so many of us who've been brought up on the false teaching that the solution to every problem is a directly spiritual solution. And that if we just read our Bibles a little bit more, and work a little harder, and pray a little more, then the thing will take care of itself. We attribute everything to a spiritual deficiency. And furthermore, we've been taught that to seek help is to admit our own spiritual weakness. Now, this is an utterly false concept. I'm glad it's dying out, and I hope it'll be completely gone in a few years. For I've seen some terribly unhappy Christian couples who go on for years and years and years, unable to change some deeply neurotic patterns in their marriage. Unable to find help and victory. Why? Because they were too spiritually proud to admit they needed help. They would rather have kept their halos on straight than to found happiness in their marriage and their lives. We've forgotten James 5:16. Confess your faults to one another. Pray for one another. Why? So that you may be healed. Don't rob yourself. Don't rob your marriage of great healing and help by failing to do this. Now, finally, and I put a whole lot of things in this, covers a lot of territory. A great factor that tends to break up a marriage is the inability to resolve conflict. The inability to resolve conflict. I've said it before. You've heard me say it, I don't say it just to be cute or to be facetious. I say it to many a couple who comes to me for help, that your difficulty, I say, is that you have to learn to fight like Christians. Now, this is true. Christians have conflicts. Every marriage includes a certain amount of conflict. In fact, every intimate human relationship includes conflict. The couple who says that they never disagree or they never have a conflict are either both liars or one is a vegetable. I don't know which. Of course you have conflict. The question is not do you have conflict. The important question is how do you resolve your conflict? What is your problem-solving, conflict-resolving device? Is it sheer noise? Is it argument? Do you settle your disputes on the basis of decibels? So that he who shouts the loudest wins? Is it physical violence? How do you solve your problems? Oh, there are many ways. The name is Legion of the wrong ways that we try to resolve our conflicts. Now, I think the greatest crisis in marriage is discovering mature Christian ways of resolving differences and conflict. And probably the most important ingredient in this is the willingness and the ability, as Paul says, to grow up in the Lord and speak the truth in love. Speak the truth, but speak it in love. The trouble with most of us as husbands and wives, we do not tell the truth to one another until we get so mad that when we say it, then our partner says, well, he was just mad, he really didn't mean it. Well, he may have meant every word of it, but we lost the effectiveness of it. If we can speak the truth in love, to get things out in the open and talk them over intelligently and lovingly. You see, usually our feelings are so pent up that the problem cannot be solved until the emotions are let out and eased. How can we solve this problem and arrive at a Christian solution? That should be the question we ask, not how can I get what I want, or I'll show her this time. Philip's translation that I read is so good. If you are angry, be sure that it's not out of wounded pride or bad temper. Never go to bed angry. Don't give the devil that sort of foothold. Another verse in Ephesians is a favorite of mine in my own marriage and when I counsel couples. Ephesians 4:32. Standing at the foot of the cross together. Paul says, be kind one to another. Tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. You see, standing at the foot of the cross together, both partners can realize then how much they have been forgiven by God. And this makes it easier. It gives grace to forgive one another for Christ's sake. And gradually this becomes not just an event, not just a series of events, but it becomes the basic underlying attitude of both partners until they stop looking for perfection in one another. They look for perfection only in God. And they become as loving and as accepting and as forgiving of one another, even as God has been toward them. I remember, oh, it's been maybe 6 or 7 years, I think it was almost the first year that we were here. I remember that I had an important engagement. It was in Washington, or near there. I was to fly from Lexington to Washington, and we were very late in getting to the airplane in Lexington. Now, Mark Twain said there were only two kinds of people in the world. Those who were always 10 minutes ahead of time, and those who were always 10 minutes late. And he said they're always married to one another. Now, that's true in my household. And I was sweating and fuming and fussing because I'm a kind of a schedule maniac, and my wife couldn't care less about clocks and things like that. And so we finally got to the plane, and we got there, and the man said, I'm sorry, we've taken your name off the list. Oh, boy, I tell you, I didn't feel too good about that. But after a little argument, we finally got on. They said, well, you can ride as far as Charleston or Huntington, whatever it was, and then we'll see if you can go any further. Well, I was upset, and I said so in no uncertain terms. Well, when I got to Charleston, proved to be plenty of room. Then finally I got to Washington. But between Charleston and Washington, you know, the Holy Spirit sort of began to whisper to me. Said, now, you're going to hold a revival, aren't you? I said, yes, I believe I am at that. And you know, by the time I got to Washington, I got a postcard in the airport. I wrote Helen, and I said, I'm sorry. And by the time I got out to the Asbury, where I was holding the revival a few days away, here was a call from Helen. She said, I'm so sorry that I made you late. I felt bad. And that was it. It was all over. Oh, I could preach my revival. I was all right.
But I don't know how I'd have preached, you know, with that sort of thing on my heart. Be kind, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. This ability to resolve our conflicts at the foot of the cross, in the love of God. Only in God's love is there sufficient love to meet every need in marriage. There are times in marriage when the cup of human love can run low. It can even seem empty or go dry. And then we must hold our cup of human love up before God's great Niagara of divine love, and we must ask Him to refill our cups. And when we give Him our willingness to love, He always gives us the power to love and the feelings of love. And His supernatural love, you see, soon rekindles our natural love. And this is what Paul means when he says, love never fails.